the burghers' courage before death by making them all the same height. Intended for ground level, the very spot on which the six volunteers died, and to be elbowed by the living and watered by the city's dogs, Rodin wanted his bronze figures to show something unprecedented in public monuments. That true courage meant the triumph over fear. Heroism in public art was thus reduced to life size. Rodin was forced to accept the pedestal and a different site, but otherwise he succeeded in imposing his artistic vision and principles on commissioners and the public. Almost a century later, and reflecting the insular formalist evolution in modern sculpture in America, Richard Serra explained his motives for the controversial tilted art in Lower Manhattan as follows. Placing pieces in an urban context is not synonymous with an interest in a large audience, even though the work will be seen by many people who would otherwise not look at art. The work I make does not grow from experience outside of the conventions of sculpture as sculpture. My audience is necessarily a limited one. It is the needs of art, not the public, that come first. Proposition two. By contrast with traditions, and begin with Rodin, modern public sculpture has celebrated art and life rather than the dead and dying for one's country. As opposed to specificity of meaning, modern sculptors have preferred open-ended interpretations, and they have often sought the monumental without the monument. By example, Rodin's Thinker, first publicly installed in 1906, as you see on the screen at the left, was never intended to honor a single dead artist. The congregating figure was originally meant to celebrate all artists, past, present, and future. Artists who think about art and life, and who through the good of intellect and hard physical work realize their vision. When detached from its original home in the gates of hell, you see at the right, the sculpture's meaning became colored by its contexts, whether a national shrine, a university campus, or an art museum, not just for the public, but for the sculptor himself. When he placed the thinker before the Pantheon in Paris, Rodin reread his own figure as a social symbol, a symbol of all workers. The thinker's perpetual relevance is constantly certified by cartoonists and advertisers. Brancusi's The Kiss was first made as a personal statement, but he agreed to its installation in 1910, atop the grave of a young Romanian woman in the Montparnasse Cemetery. It is not the conventional funerary image of grief, but by showing a copulating couple, Rancusi affirmed his belief, and that of all modern sculptors, in an art of life over death. Almost 30 years later, Rancusi's Gate of the Kiss, made for the war memorial at Târgu in Romania, projected again his belief in the force of life, but on a heroic scale. Some years ago in the city of Chicago, there were those who wanted a monument to a famous baseball player. Instead of a statue, the federal government accepted Klaus Oldenburg's proposal for a gigantic steel baseball bat. Monumental size brought attention to the abstract shape, but not the utility of the bat. For Oldenburg, his form provided not only a reminder of Chicago's love of baseball, thereby realizing the artist's dream of an ironic monument cross structure you see on the right, looking up into it, also evoked one of the great skyscrapers for which Chicago is known. Mark the Subaru sculpture exemplifies the preference of many abstract artists for the monumental without the monument. For Lady Day, which refers to the late blues singer Billie Holiday, is the name and not the title of this work. It was a dedication, like what Don Chilita was speaking about earlier, how he has dedicated some of his works to friends, like Over Kaya. It's a dedication, not an explanation. The inspiring subject for Mark was a big, vigorous, open-form structure, both fixed and movable. It represents modern sculpture's stricter unity of form and meaning than in the past. Lady Day is a celebration of the modern sculptor's art that also serves as a public playground. Proposition 3. Recent developments in modern public sculpture have shown, however, that there remains the need for memorials through which the community may publicly express private grief. Contradicting the view that modern sculpture lacks the power of past public art, there have been examples of artists treating controversial subjects that have stirred the community. Maya Lane Lynn's Monument to the Vietnam Veterans in Washington, D.C., has won national support in terms of respect and affection. Since its dedication, it has been the place where hundreds of thousands of Americans have come to unashamedly mourn in public. No single act of the American government has done more towards healing the nation's wounds and the Vietnam veterans' sense of not having been appreciated than this memorial. Let me add in parenthesis, in many American communities at this moment, similar memorials have been built or are being planned, and there is a portable miniature version of Maya Lane Lynn's memorial that's been touring the United States for years. Despite bitter opposition before its installation, George Siegel's Survivor, a tribute to the victims of the Holocaust, was commissioned by a Jewish group in San Francisco. It has become the goal of pilgrimages. On any day, it is not unusual to see flowers that have been placed in the hands of Siegel's plaster figures or at the feet of the survivor. The grim sculpture's location is a spectacularly beautiful natural site on the edge of San Francisco. Any objection to this? What George's rejoinder was, he justified his grim subject in a beautiful location because it showed the dark side of human nature. George Siegel's Gay Liberation was intended as a tribute to a minority struggling for its civil rights and to emphasize the common humanity of homosexuals and lesbians. The sponsor was the late Peter Putnam and his Mildred Andrews Fund, which supported only controversial public art in order to raise public consciousness. Gay Liberation is installed on the Stanford University campus. It's been a great source of comfort and pride to the gay community, as well as despair, as I will later show. But in sum, memorials are back in favor because people still want to remember their past, and in many forms. And now some modern artists believe they can handle these projects on their own terms. Proposition 4. Recent history has shown also that modern public sculpture, intentionally or not, can again serve the traditional needs of community pride of place by means of a civic symbol. Examples. Although not so intended by the artist, several modern public sculptures have been adopted by communities as civic symbols. Picasso's Head of a Woman is as tough a public sculpture for a city to come to terms with as was ever made. The favorable international attention the sculpture brought to the city and the pride of association with the great artist won out over initial ridicule. And for years, Picasso's sculpture has served on travel posters as an emblem of a renewed Chicago. One of the first post-World War II government-funded public sculptures in America was Sandy Calder's Grande Vitesse. After a stormy start, it was literally adopted by Grand Rapids, Michigan, the name Grande Vitesse, given by Calder to his work, a kind of pun on Grand Rapids, Michigan. The stadial silhouette image is the city's logo, even on sanitation trucks, as you can see it at the right. Artists, you know you've arrived if you see the rocket.
No.
Communal acceptance, in turn, converted the then previously skeptical President Gerald Ford to the cause of government support of public art. George Siegel's Steelworkers honors not just the city of Youngstown, Ohio, but the steelworkers who lived there and manned the great mills, no longer in operation. The memorial's communal acceptance was helped by the fact that two former steelworkers, seen in the photograph at the right with the artist, were used by Siegel as his models, as well as a section of an actual skeletal open heart furnace. By eliminating the pedestal and bigger-than-life heroes, Siegel modernized successfully the tradition of the monument. There is evidence in America that the tradition of the conservative monument and its use of personification continues in lively form. For the city of Portland and the architect Michael Graves, a young former abstract artist named Raymond Haskey actually hammered and applied copper sheeting over a steel framework to create the form of a personification of the city. I have brought with me, and it is on view, a videotape of the competition for this work, the selection of Haskey, how the work was made, and most interesting of all, how the city received it when it was brought to Portland just a few years ago. Portlandia, as the figure is called, derives from the city's seal. It is the second largest hammered copper sculpture of its kind in America, second only to the Statue of Liberty. To the consternation of some modernists, Portlandia has become a source of civic enjoyment and pride. Many among the community of artists welcome its animation and contrast with the flat facade of Graves Municipal Building. Proposition 5. There still remains the old need to replace or counter ugliness with beauty in public spaces. And one of the great purposes served by modern public sculpture has been to humanize the urban environment through wit, poetry, and history, and by means of beauty to counter bad architecture, and even to reclaim devastated nature. In many ways, there are times when architects are grateful for public sculpture, when it fails. Because then the community is angry at the sculpture. They never get angry at architects for bad architecture. Never. Henry Moore always believed that sculpture and public should offer people the extraordinary in terms of form and meaning and bring mystery and beauty into their humdrum lives. He also knew that placed in front of any building more than two stories high, a sculpture would look out of scale. Sculpture that is in scale with its architectural or spatial environment can be intimidating to people, as Richard Serra discovered in New York City. In compensation, however, as Moore's art showed, when installed before the San Francisco Symphony Building, sculpture can redefine or expand what the public understands as beauty and be a gift to the street, restoring human presence and scale to the impersonal built urban environment. In the drive to make cities more lovable and livable, certain American sculptors have created their own abstract architecture. The landscape architect Lawrence Halpin has made his own sculpture for imaginative urban fountains, such as the one in Portland, Oregon, before a very mediocre civic auditorium building. Halpin describes his work as a people's park, for the fountain is conceived not just to be heard and seen, but entered into and passed behind. Since 1970, the fountain has given great pleasure to the city day and night, and this goodwill partly explains its admirable maintenance. Robert Morris's earthwork for King County, Washington, was made from an old 4-acre gravel pit that had become an embarrassment for the county. Paris with grass, the size of the kitchen. The resulting undulating rhythms and shadows change dramatically with the light. From its bottom, one sees only the sky, but from the top, there is a splendid view of the valley. At one time, a hard-nosed, hard-headed, dogmatic formalist, Robert Morris's sculptured natural amphitheater has been a model of public art used for the reclamation of nature. Because of these and other examples to follow, being a civic-minded citizen rather than a rebel now seems in America compatible with being a modern artist. Proposition 6. Another and growing recent development has been the rejection of the public be damned attitude of certain modern artists and the deliberate creation of what's known as viewer-friendly public art, in which the artist may collaborate with other professionals and the community. In the United States, Isamu Noguchi was the pioneering modern sculptor of what is now called site-specific art. He wanted public art that people would enjoy if they had enjoyed parks, gardens, and playgrounds when they were young. In such projects as his Chase Manhattan Bank Plaza in New York City, that you see at the left, and his Costa Mesa Plaza in California, that you see at the right, Noguchi fulfills his earlier dreams of taking over an entire open urban space and providing its furniture, landscaping, and art. The results are inviting places where office workers and other city dwellers can escape the stress and tedium of business. No modern artist has been more imaginative, venturesome, and energetic in his projects for viewer-friendly public art than Christo. He has ingeniously combined the communist and capitalist system by creating art for the masses, whose construction involves hundreds of skilled and unskilled workers, all paid for through the sale of his preparatory drawings. No artist spends anywhere near the time, ingenuity, and patience as Christo does in educating the public and government officials into his art and proposals. His short-lived projects, like the running fence, erected in Northern California in 1977, are enjoyed by hundreds of thousands of people. They appreciate his concern for the environment, the audacity of his thinking, and the sheer beauty of the spectacles he creates. Christo is never plagued by the problems involved with permanence and taxpayer revolts. His projects serve to refocus interest in the beauty or historical importance of the sites chosen. Sometimes dismissed as theater by his critics, Christo's art teaches us that great theater, which is free, is always better than dull or intimidating public sculpture paid for by angry taxpayers. Another lesson to be learned from artists such as Oldenburg, Coleman, Petrucci, and Tristo in the United States is that successful, serious public art can also be fun and is very much needed and appreciated by the public at all times. Proposition 7. In certain countries, the modern sculptor has won unprecedented rights in the form of laws protecting public as well as private art. Under the Berne Convention for the Protection of Literary and Artistic Works, artists have the right to claim authorship of their work and to object to any distortion, mutilation, or other modification which would be prejudicial to their honor and reputation. The United States is still not a party to the Berne Convention, but some states now have laws that protect what is known as the artist's moral right. Isamu Noguchi's sculpture, Shinto, which you see at the left, was owned by the Bank of Tokyo and specifically commissioned for the lobby of its New York City headquarters. Without the artist's knowledge and consent, Shinto was taken down in 1980, cut up to permit its removal from the building, then reassembled and sold to someone else. Unprotected then and even now by New York State law, Noguchi could only renounce his authorship in the work. If this had taken place in California after 1982, Noguchi might have been able to prevent Shinto's mutilation if he had been warned, and if not, he would have had a cause of legal action. At least one California sculptor has been a beneficiary of his state's enlightened law, which is called the Artistic and Creations Preservation Act. In 1964, a sculptor named Carol Barnes, where you see at the right, completed a monumental abstract sculpture for the Sun-Made Raisin Company in Fresno, California. Over the years, he used this work to win many other commissions. In 1984, however, he discovered that his sculpture had been demolished by its owner, contrary to the California law that required giving the artist the opportunity of recovering the work at his own expense before its intentional destruction. Barnes filed suit and, in effect, won when he received an out-of-court settlement from the company. What we've learned since Rodin is that it's in the public interest, not just that of the artist, to legally protect works of art from deterioration and destruction. Proposition 8. Recent history has shown that in America, the public is also increasingly exerting its rights to protect and protest public sculpture. For the sake of argument, let us define public sculpture as that which the public has free access, and which is usually funded directly or indirectly by the taxpayer. Following almost a century-long struggle for artists' rights, the American public seems now more alert to its legal and ethical rights. When a work of public art that is destined to be permanent and without review pleases or offends its sensibilities. In the last 10 years, sculptors have been faced increasingly with the historically new demand that their public work be submitted to a human environmental impact report. The following events explain why. In 1983, Red Rooms was commissioned by a Denver, Colorado oilman to make a public sculpture that would upgrade the cultural energy of that city. The resulting work showed a caricature of a cowboy and Indian in what Rooms called a shootout. The sculpture had to be relocated 3 times and finally removed to a walled courtyard of the Denver Art Museum. The causes of these relocations were public protests, including those by feminists and Native American Indians over the trivializing of violence and the public demeaning of Indians who are still subjected to suffering and persecution. The lesson learned is that modern culture, far from lacking power, can still outrage as well as inspire. But a modern sculptor is insensitive to the fact that the location of his work makes it a hot subject. He and his commissioner can get burned, and for reasons that are not all frivolous. In 1975, a group of federal judges protested the placement of George Sugarman's government commissioned work, People's Sculpture, before the Baltimore Federal Senate. The judges argued that the work did not signify the gravity of the law, that it was a physical hazard and a potential shelter for persons bent on mischief or assault on the public. And this included the hiding of bombs in the sculpture. At a public hearing in 1976, however, Sugarman received overwhelming support from the public, artists, and non-artists from the art world. The powerful judges were effectively overruled by the people. The lesson learned is that no longer can the American public be stereotyped simply as Philistines where good art is concerned. In the famous case of Sarah's Tilted Art, it was judges again who led the drive to remove a government commissioned sculpture from in front of federal buildings. This time, and through petitions in a public hearing, many government employees and residents of Lower Manhattan registered their displeasure as well. Sarah had strong backing from the art world. Let me just say that the art world people who spoke for Sarah could be characterized as follows. Their approval was in direct proportion to the distance they lived from the sculpture. Proposition 9. Public acceptance of modern sculpture, even of the highest quality, has always involved risk for the artist. But recent history has taught that the public's education, including that by commissioners and artists, helps to reduce those risks. In 1977, when Carl Andre installed his Stonefield sculpture in the center of Hartford, Connecticut, next to an old church and cemetery, there was such a public outcry of protest that it became national news. There followed extensive discussion in the press, both pro and con. And Andre gave several lectures in Hartford on his work in general, as well as Stonefield sculpture. The subsequent general acceptance and popular enjoyment of this once controversial public sculpture reinforces the lesson that educating the public in advance is both prudent and wise. Still another lesson is that people find it hard to make a sculpture they can sit on or picnic near. I will cite a personal example. When Kenneth Nelson's All-Star Front was erected on the Stanford University campus, thanks to a grant from the federal government. The work was done by graduate students in our School of Engineering. You can see them in this photograph. They proclaimed to one and all that Ken's sculpture was the slickest engineering they had ever seen. Besides the public lecture, the artist was present during its construction, and Snelson answered hundreds of questions from passing students. The sculpture's success was due in large part to the community feeling it had a part, small as it was, in the works coming into being. My last proposition, Proposition 10. How expose our works of art to all nations? Quotation. How expose our works of art to all nations? The permanence of public sculpture has always been problematic. That's the proposition. The quotation is from a French writer named Henri Pellin, who in 1905 wrote about the destruction of a cast of Rodin's Tinker in front of the Pantheon by a hatchet-wielding madman. You see it in the cartoon on the left. Her 6 years later, the Paris Municipal Council removed the thinker from in front of the Pantheon without a public hearing or explanation, reminding us that permanent installation in modern times are still vulnerable to politicians. Even before the time of Rodin, public sculpture was exposed to determined vandalism. In 1971, however, during public protest against the Vietnam War and urban racial violence, the bronze cast of the thinker in front of the Cleveland Museum of Art was blown up with plastique by an unknown person. The museum director had the sculpture reinstalled in its damaged state as testimony to the time. That's the way you'll see the thinker today in front of the Cleveland Museum of Art. Just a few years ago, George Siegel's Liberation was hammered 53 times by an unknown assailant who the Stanford University gay community alleges was a homophobe. Rather than serving as a consciousness-raising work, Siegel is dismayed that his art has become a lightning rod